This year, more than 100 people will attempt to swim across the English Channel. Most of the swimmers are in their 20s and 30s, but 60-year-old Pat Gallant-Charette from Westbrook, Maine, is preparing for her third attempt. Patty White has this profile.
You could easily call Pine Point Beach in Scarborough, Maine, Pat Gallant-Charette's second home. When she isn't working as a nurse or watching her grandkids, she's here, 6 days a week from April to November. Wearing just a black one-piece bathing suit, Pat does a quick toe check before entering the water.
It's warm. This is good. I'd say right now it's probably, I have to guess, 63, maybe 64.
Of course this feels warm to Pat. Official English Channel swimmers aren't allowed to wear wetsuits. When she first started training for the swim 5 years ago, she took ice baths to acclimate to cold water.
So I'd sit and read the newspaper, a book, or whatever, and stay in for, you know, for a short time, you know, up to an hour.
Pat walks in till she's waist deep, then glides under. She'll cling to the shoreline for the entire swim. It's safer, but it's also more challenging. A treadmill of rolling waves pick Pat up and seem to want to carry her sideways to shore. Pat swims from 1 to 10 hours a day, morning, noon, and night. When she arrives in England later this month, she'll need to be ready to start swimming at any time during a 10-day window. Pat took up swimming 14 years ago. She started in honor of her brother Robbie, an avid swimmer, who died unexpectedly of a heart attack. Back then, she wasn't sure she could even swim 2 laps in a pool.
And the first time I swam an hour nonstop, my heavens, it was like I was on cloud nine. And even at that time, I never, ever imagined that I was going to be going into marathon swimming. It just slowly developed over the years.
She made her first attempt for the English Channel in 2008. She swam for 12 hours through jellyfish stings and biting fish. Then, just a mile and a half from the finish, current stalled her in place for 4 hours and she had to pull the plug. Last year, bad weather prevented her from even getting in the water. This time, Pat doesn't even consider not finishing. At 60, she says she's the strongest she's ever been.
I thought that, you know, after the age of 50, it's all downhill, and it's not. But I'll be curious what I'll be at 70, because my mom's 86, and she swims 3 days a week, so I think I have a few good years ahead of me.
There will be more swims, but the English Channel, says Pat, is the biggest swim of her life. This one is for her brother, Robbie. For NPR News, I'm Patty White.
This is NPR News.
All right, let's be honest. There's a reason I picked that last song. Let It Be plays a central role in the book we're talking about today. It's set in 1970, which was one bummer of a year. The 60s were definitely over. The violence at Altamont Speedway and the shootings at Kent State saw to that. College campuses were exploding, sometimes literally. Radical groups like the Weather Underground were on the move all across the country. It was an anxious, uncertain time, and when people flipped on the radio, they wanted something soothing, something like Simon and Garfunkel. Or James Taylor.
Whoa, I've seen fire and I've seen rain.
Fire and Rain was Taylor's first big hit. It's also the title of David Brown's new book, Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNY, and the Lost Story of 1970. Brown says he's always been haunted by the idea that he missed out on the 60s.
Which were like the greatest period ever in mankind. And, you know, you missed out on the Beatles and the Kennedys and Flower Power and on and on. And
don't you wish you were born 5 or 10 years earlier?
Exactly. And here you are in the era of Watergate and gas rationing and Seals and Crofts. And, you know, and so it's always haunted me to some degree since then. Well, what did happen? What changed there? When did that decade turn into this, you know, gloomier 70s? So basically, I wanted to tell a story of kind of the end of one era and one decade and one sensibility, really, and another. And these four acts really kind of fit that bill. Here you have three of the most iconic groups of the 60s, Simon and Garfunkel, The Beatles, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, releasing these landmark albums that year, Let It Be and Bridge Over Troubled Water and Deja Vu, and then imploding. And then rising out of those ashes is this guy named James Taylor, who was really an obscure, almost cult figure at the beginning of 1970, yet by the end of the year emerged as the rising new star of the year and ushering in that kind of singer-songwriter, more introspective, far less political sensibility.
If 1970 was this important year, and you've talked about there being this generation gap in music fans in some way, and there was a new generation of listeners coming up, why does James Taylor's sound sort of catch on and those other icons sort of fall by the wayside?
I think with James Taylor, he really was sort of the right guy at the right time. I think by the end of 1970, which is when the song Fire and Rain really finally clicked in and became a hit after being a word-of-mouth song all year, people were just really exhausted after 3 years, 68, 69, and 70, of political assassinations and anti-war protests and the Democratic Convention in 68, the Manson murders, Altamont, Kent State. I mean, it was just this laundry list of horrors. And I think
anger just boiling over everywhere.
Anger boiling over, and it was just an exhausting time. And I think by the end of 1970, it was just one of those convergences of cultural mood and music. And so a song like Fire Rain and a guy like James Taylor, who was very upfront at the time in talking about what he'd been through those last couple of years, and he talked about it with me for the book as well, his own drug problems and his stay is in mental hospitals. I mean, he was very he would allude to these things in his stage patter, and I think a lot of people really connected with that.
So you've arranged your book chronologically, and you started on the 3rd of January 1970 with what I really think might be the most important story in the book, and that was the beginning of the end of the Beatles.
Right.
What happened?
That was the very last recording session they did together before Paul kind of announced to the world in April that he was going off on his own.
You talk about a letter that John Lennon and George Harrison wrote to Paul McCartney. which if there was anything that sort of showed that the Beatles were falling apart, this sort of sent that message home. Could you read that letter?
Oh, sure.
How it was addressed to
yes.
McCartney?
Yeah, well, set up, which is that in early 1970, Paul McCartney went off on his own to make his own record. So Paul says, okay, I've done this record. I want to put it out on this day in April. And the other guys in the band are concerned because they want to put out the Let It Be album then. And, in their mind, you can't glut the market. So on March 30th, John and George drafted a letter and had Ringo hand deliver it to Paul at his house in St. John's Wood right near the Abbey Road studio. And it says, it's addressed to you from us.
Simple.
Very simple. Dear Paul, we thought a lot about yours and the Beatles LPs and decided it's stupid for Apple to put out two big albums within 7 days of each other. So we sent a letter to EMI telling them to hold your release date until June 4th. There's a big Apple Capital convention in Hawaii then. We thought you'd come around when you realized that the Beatles album was coming out on April 24th. We're sorry it turned out like this. It's nothing personal. Love, John and George. And then George put a little postscript at the end, a little thorny olive branch where he says, Hail Krishna, a mantra a day keeps Maya away. I hope my friend gets joy from that. I read this letter to someone who worked with Paul back then, and he just said, yeah, George had a way of making Hare Krishna sound like F you. And I think that was a perfect example of that. Yeah.
Well, however it was intended, Paul McCartney did not take the letter well.
He did not. Ringo went back to the other guys and said, look, why don't we just stay with that date and we'll move Let It Be and we'll work it out, and which is what they did.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them.
I'm speaking to David Brown, who's the author of Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNY, and The Lost Story of 1970. And we can't neglect the story of Simon and Garfunkel in 1970. I mean, here they are about to score one of their biggest hits, Bridge Over Troubled Water, which, the name in itself sort of seems to capture a lot of what the country was trying to find in that year. But they suddenly just disappear. What happened to them?
They had known each other at that point for a long time, about 15 years. They were, school friends in Queens, New York. And, they'd always had a kind of edgy relationship. And I think by the time of the Bridge album, the making of the Bridge album in 69 and into early 70, These were guys who were basically were growing apart as people and as musicians. And it's so fascinating that you don't hear any of that on the Bridge album.
You name the book Fire and Rain. If there's a soundtrack to the very troubled year of 1970, should that be the song we sort of put at the top of our list as representing that period?
Well, I think it probably would be. You know, as songs go, I mean, Let It Be, you know, there it would be a good soundtrack song there, maybe in The Long and Winding Road, maybe in Bridge Over Troubled Water, but something about, yeah, I think something about Fire and Rain, and the way that that song talks about one guy's journey through, you know, his own psychic problems and a death of a friend by a drug overdose and career problems up to that point, and I think that really does, song does really capture that moment in time.
It's the voice of author David Brown. His new book is called Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon & Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNY, and The Lost Story of 1970. David, keep enjoying the music. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
See you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. You just got to see me through another day.
And for Saturday, that's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm David Green. Remember, you can hear the best of this program on our podcast. Subscribe or listen at iTunes or at npr.org/weekendATC. We post a new episode Sunday nights. We're back with a whole new hour of radio tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening and have a great night.
Political rhetoric isn't sitting well with investors these days. The turmoil on Wall Street threatens to wreak financial havoc on a lot of people and institutions, including the country's 1.2 million nonprofits. Charities of all sizes are only beginning to recover from the recession. Now, many are wondering how they'll survive another market plunge. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
At Camp Henry on Manhattan's Lower East Side, a few dozen children are getting ready to rehearse a dance number for a video they plan to make.
Kayla, come here. Serene, come here. Shine.
The camp is run by the venerable Henry Street Settlement, which provides a range of social services for low-income New Yorkers. Executive Director David Garza says after the 2008 financial crisis, corporate donations to the agency fell off.
It was really a kind of a vice grip on the supply side and the demand side, where there's more demand for our services and less resources to provide the services.
For a while, federal stimulus money helped keep the agency going, but now that's dried up. So Garza has been watching the recent Wall Street meltdown with some trepidation.
It starts actually in the stomach, and then it goes through the mind, and it's a here-we-go-again feeling.
A big drop in stock prices tends to hurt charities in two ways. First, many own stocks directly through their endowments, and their holdings lose value, or at least they no longer pay the kinds of dividends they once did. Second, individuals and companies can no longer afford to donate as much as they used to, says nonprofit consultant Bob Evans.
We know that this will impose some significant challenges as donors try to fund pledges that they've made or nonprofits try to keep attracting the charitable dollars that they do need.
Evans says after the 2008 financial crisis, donations to all kinds of charities dropped, including those involved in the arts, social services, and medicine. Evans says donations finally began to increase again last year, but the downturn in the economy could set them back again. Elizabeth Egbert is president and CEO of the Staten Island Museum in New York. She says the museum has been writing to donors lately, and fewer of them seem willing to make gifts.
The negative letters seem to be more candid about the limited resources and the many voices asking for support. So the competition for money is much greater.
The troubles are aggravated by the fact that the museum gets much of its operating budget from New York City. When there's a downturn on Wall Street, city tax revenues tend to fall, and New York has a lot less money to hand out. So the museum has to make do with less.
I can't add staff. So we are looking to volunteers more. We're asking more of our board. We're just trying to be better at everything we do.
That has helped the museum survive and even grow at a very difficult time. But like a lot of nonprofits, it faces big challenges right now, and the recent vagaries of the stock market only make the future a lot less certain. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Sometimes, when you walk Brooklyn streets, you don't feel its literary past is haunting you. Its literary soul is still alive and pulsating all around you. There's Walt Whitman in his office at the Brooklyn Daily Eagle near the Fulton Ferry dock. Here's Hart Crane writing his masterpiece about Brooklyn's masterpiece, The Bridge. Norman Mailer's former residence is above on the Palisades. Henry Miller's beloved Williamsburg is further north along the East River and has its own bridge. Brooklyn is a world unto itself and a writer's enclave. Journalist and critic Evan Hughes has written a literary biography of the leafy borough, Literary Brooklyn, The Writers of Brooklyn and the Story of American City Life. And Evan Hughes joins me now from our studios in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jackie.
I just want to say I really like this book, and I have lived in Brooklyn part-time since 1997. I say this, Evan, about the borough. Throw a stone, hit a writer. Think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. You can barely walk a block without running into an editor, an agent, or a writer.
Yes. Why has it been such a haven? Not just now, but you go back. You begin with Walt Whitman. What's the attraction?
It's a place that lends itself to stories. There's a human scale to the place that is sometimes missing in Manhattan. And if you picture a brownstone and sort of make a cut out of it, like a dollhouse, and you might have a family living on the first floor, a married couple on the second floor, a student on the third floor. At the end of the block, there's a deli. The guy works at the deli. He's sort of a gossip and talks to all three of them. You've got a little world there that stories take place in. I think it's very fertile for an author's imagination.
And we should talk about how big it is. I hadn't realized. You say it's bigger than...
It's bigger than Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Boston, and Miami combined.
Tell us about the first great Brooklyn bard. Whitman really loved Brooklyn. He really takes that whole notion of the everyman from the neighborhood.
I think to him, Brooklyn was a great laboratory of democracy. And he was a radical Democrat. And he loved this idea that he could be in opposition to Manhattan and sort of boast and pick fights. And he loved the idea of the diversity of the place and its vitality.
What poems do you think draw directly from this experience the most, in your judgment? Brooklyn Ferry?
Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, for sure.
Let's listen to a bit of actor Ed Begley reading the poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, in 1969.
Others will enter the gates of the ferry and cross from shore to shore. Others will watch the run of the flood tide. Others will see the shipping of Manhattan north and west and the heights of Brooklyn to the south and east. Others will see the islands, large and small. 50 years hence, others will see them as they cross.
Crossing Brooklyn Ferry is one portion of Leaves of Grass, and I think really the whole thing comes from his experience of a kind of raw relationship with an industrializing place, but a place that's still sort of wild.
Can we give a shout out to Arthur Miller and the setting of Death of a Salesman?
It is the iconic Brooklyn play, I would say, and it's possibly the iconic American play. So the play reflects Arthur Miller's childhood way out in Brooklyn. And, you know, there are so many stories about the American dream in the wake of World War II. You know, the world is sort of buying cars and moving to the suburbs and having babies and this great prosperity. Miller captures the flip side of that view and a man who's sort of left behind by capitalism.
I'm tired to the death. I couldn't make it. I just couldn't make it, Linda.
Where were you all day? You looked terrible.
Oh, I got as far as a little above Yonkers. I stopped for a cup of coffee. Maybe it was a coffee.
What?
I suddenly couldn't drive anymore. The car kept going off onto the shoulder. You know?
Well, maybe it's the steering.
Evan Hughes, I always identify Richard Wright with Chicago, where I used to live, but you have him writing Native Son at Fort Greene Park.
He came to Brooklyn in, I believe, 1940. This is when he wrote Native Son, and he would sort of climb to the top of the park with his legal pad and look out at the view. And that's really where, in one summer, he created a lot of the book and sort of captured the Great Migration almost as no one else did. And he also wrote Black Boy while living in Brooklyn.
I'd like to talk about Alfred Kazin, who makes his critical debut. He's only 27 years old when he writes On Native Grounds. But let's talk about the journey to write that book. Here he is talking to our colleague Susan Stamberg back in 1986.
I was born and brought up as the first son of Russian Jewish immigrants in a section of Brooklyn called Brownsville, which used to be very famous because a great many Nobel Prize winners and professional murderers came from it.
Talk about what Brownsville was like in Kazin's childhood.
Brownsville had become like a little Jerusalem. It was 95% Jewish, and it was surrounded by the signs of Jewish life. People spoke a sort of pidgin Yiddish English, and they belonged to mutual benefit societies. And it was really a world unto itself, but a world of struggle. Kazin would sometimes, in the winter, he would sleep on three chairs by the wood stove.
Let's leave this conversation, Evan Hughes, with something from Alfred Kazin's A Walker in the City, one of his best-known books. And he is referring here to Washington Roebling, the engineer who finishes building the Brooklyn Bridge. Would you please read us that passage?
I could never walk across Roebling's Bridge or past the hotel on University Place named Albert in Ryder's honor, or stop in front of the garbage cans at Fulton and Cranberry Streets in Brooklyn, at the place where Whitman had himself printed Leaves of Grass, without thinking that I had at last opened the great trunk of forgotten time in New York, in which I, too, I thought, would someday find the source of my unrest.
Evan Hughes, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks so much, Jackie.
Evan Hughes, his new book is called Literary Brooklyn: The Writers of Brooklyn and the Story of American City Life. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Time now for sports. This week, golf's PGA Championship might have cemented the downfall of Tiger Woods, while the Philadelphia Eagles hope their first preseason game was just a small step en route to a Super Bowl appearance. ESPN's Howard Bryant joins us from member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome, Howard.
Good morning, Jackie. How are you?
I'm great. Well, nice to be back with you. Hey, Tiger Woods seemed optimistic heading into this weekend until he turned in two disastrous rounds before missing the cut at 10 over par. What happened to Tiger Woods, Howard?
Well, what didn't happen to Tiger Woods? This was awful. This has been a continuation of the most spectacular collapse, I think, in American sports history. To have a player be on top of the sports world, to be the most recognizable sports figure in the world, to fall apart in so many different ways at so many different levels. It's stunning to watch, simply to see what's happened with him on the field of play. But I think it's even more stunning when you look at him in totality. He went into this tournament feeling optimistic, feeling like he had had a clean slate, and it was one of his worst rounds of his career. In fact, I think it was the third worst round of his career. And I think on top of that, what's even more stunning about Tiger is, while all this is collapsing for him on field, while his family life has collapsed, you also have some of his great sports friends who have also wondered exactly what's happened to him. Charles Barkley, Roger Federer all say that he's no longer friends with them. And so I think it's really interesting when you watch what's happened with him, a perfect storm of physical injury, of personal catastrophe. And it really is one of the most unbelievable public spectacles I think I've seen for a professional athlete.
Howard, in the absence of Tiger Woods, there are a cluster of relative unknowns at the top of the leaderboard. Do you think that newcomers like Jason Duffner or Keegan Bradley can hold on to win?
Someone's obviously going to win the tournament. That's and someone's going to be an unknown. You've got Jim Ferrick is a shot off the lead. I think he's probably the most recognizable of the top 10. Steve Stricker is a very good golfer as well. Adam Scott's down there tied for 11th. But that wow factor, that superstar factor, that's gone. And I think that the question has always been over the last 15 years has been, are people watching golf for golf, or are they watching golf for Tiger? And you don't have that big name anymore. But that's the beauty of the sport as well. No matter who's playing, it always does come down to that final weekend. You've got the top 14 players are within four shots. So you're going to have some Sunday drama here.
Well, let's go over to football. The Philadelphia Eagles think they're ready to show up the New England Patriots and the Green Bay Packers. That's something. Will the locked-out shortened training camp hurt the Eagles?
Oh, I think it's going to be a while before we find out exactly how the lockout really affected anybody. The one thing we do know is that the Eagles they said they were going to be aggressive once the lockout ended. They have been. They've got all kinds of stars. They're loaded. Everybody wants to play for them. And I think where you're going to see a lot of the residue of the lockout is if you get a lot of early injuries, if you start getting conditioning injuries, hamstrings, cramps, those types of things, some of those nagging injuries that a complete preseason and training camp might have avoided. But on the field right now, you've got the Eagles, the Patriots, the Packers. Those teams are really very, very good teams. They've loaded up. The Packers are the defending champions. I think those are the three teams certainly that everyone's going to be watching.
Howard, let's live dangerously. Talk about the Detroit Lions. For the first time since Barry Sanders retired, a bit of buzz surrounding the team.
It's been a while. Let's face it, the type of buzz that the Detroit Lions have created for the past several years has been the spectacular way that they've lost football games. Let's face it, in 2008, they didn't win a game, 0-16. And I've always said that a trained monkey could actually make the playoffs in football because the rules are set up that everyone has a chance, and the Detroit Lions haven't had one. This team hasn't won half of its games. They haven't been .500 since 2000. They haven't made the playoffs since 1999. But they've got a great defense. They've got a good young quarterback with Matthew Stafford. And for the first time, you may actually look at the Lions, even though they are in a tough division, you may look at them as a team that could knock on the door for the playoffs, believe it or not.
Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the Magazine. Pleasure to talk to you, Howard.
Oh, my pleasure.